Well, let's get started then. My name is Peter Fever, and my colleague Kenneth Gears to my left. I want to say up front that I have heard every joke that can be made about my name, just in case anyone wants to test me on that. I've probably heard it. I'm not a computer security professional. I don't even play one on TV. I'm a political scientist. And my interest in this area was wondering whether what you all do, what political impact it could have at the broader national and especially the international scene. Can what computer security professionals do or fail to do from time to time, can that matter for international politics? And that's what this talk is about. It's a departure for the black hat talks, which I gather are far more technical in nature. This is going to be more political in nature, but hopefully it will stimulate a discussion in the Q&A that will blend the two. Now, what we're going to talk about it briefly is asymmetric warfare and globalized warfare, and then how those trends, which certainly predate the internet age, how those have merged with the internet age to produce asymmetric globalized hacking. And talk, and Kenneth is going to go into some detail about the targeting and attack strategies in a specific case, several cases, but focusing on the Middle East conflict. And then we'll bring it back to a broader look at what works, what doesn't work, what is the most powerful cyber weapon, and where is this taking us to the future. Now, asymmetric warfare is as old as Sun Tzu, so it's thousands of years old. It's attacking the enemy where they are weak rather than attacking them where they are strong. It's supposed to be innovative forms of strategy where you imagine yourself to that you have a plan that would be better than what the other guy is doing. And it's leveraging perceived weaknesses to your own tactical advantage. And in many cases, it involves attacking the will of the target rather than their capacity to fight, their willingness to fight. It's the strategy, the preferred strategy of the weaker side. It is what combatants that are at a disadvantage do when they are faced with a more formidable foe. And of course, it's used by terrorists, most famously in the 9/11 incident, the media, and we would argue by computer hackers. Now, hacking provides an especially attractive form of asymmetric warfare because of the anonymity that you get through the internet. And if you're a government organization involved in this, you get some plausible deniability so that your hands are not directly linked to the activity. It's also, of course, very affordable. You don't have to be you don't have to have the military capacity. You don't have to spend the vast sums that the United States spends in order to counter the United States. And of particular interest, I think, is the ability to mobilize subcultures who may be sympathetic to your cause but might not otherwise be willing to participate in a militarized conflict. But this the hacking gives them an opportunity to go. It's kind of the modern-day equivalent of the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, where people rallied to the cause and went over to Spain to fight on one side or the other. The hacking provides that same kind of posses of the willing, if you will. And that's what makes it global and not just international. International is between states. Global, it refers to the emptying of state power and transnational actors, sub-state actors, or stateless actors. And in particular, commercial actors. And that's one of the things that when we get to the Middle East section, you'll see that the targets are often government sites, but also corporations that are linked to the offending country. And it's part of this broader phenomenon of outsourcing warfare. So you see Halliburton providing logistical support on the battlefield. You see Blackwater Security providing security functions, both functions that the military used to do in-house. Now they outsource it. In a sense, hacking is further outsourcing the conflict, involving private citizens and citizens groups in it. And the corporations are key and active participants, both as targets and possibly as combatants. In this sense, it's a little bit like it's going back to a pre-modern phase of warfare. If the modern industrial age warfare was the armies of nation states clashing against each other, the pre-modern era, the feudal era, where there were mercenaries, corporate interests, guilds, etc., all involved in the conflict, we're moving in that same direction. And of course, it is done without a traditional chain of command, without a clear ability to stop it, for instance, if it's getting started. And it crosses the boundaries. So folks who are sympathizers but not state citizens of the combatants are able to join in. Now, the two most obvious forms of, or the most prominent forms of cyber attacks are the denial of service attacks and the defacement attacks. And for this reason, businesses are often the target. The loss of revenue for the business, that's the key vulnerability, and for the governments, it's the loss of face, it's the embarrassment, it's the shame factor when your computers have been taken over by another party. And of course, the raises the questions, the classic problem of security professionals is balancing significant or merely vulnerable sites, and as we'll see in the Middle East case, that those introduce interesting asymmetries on the two sides. And there is a growing development of states doing the hacking themselves, not just private individuals. So when we talk about the Chinese case in particular, we'll talk about involvement by groups that seem to have some level of possible state sponsorship. Most of hacking is just for fun or for the technical challenge of it. But what's interesting from our point of view is about one-fifth is political, either because it's a cause, say, anti-globalization or the Arab-Israeli conflict, or patriotism, that you feel that your country has been wronged by this other country or by this other corporation, and you are doing this to make a patriotic statement of your love for your country. And that one-fifth is a sizable amount of political hacking. Of course, the challenges are the same challenges that you know better than I do. How do you keep track of who attacked you? How can you trace it back to the source and not just the vulnerability that was exploited, but to get it back to the person who was doing it? And if the hack was state-sponsored, what kind of support are you going to get from the other state in terms of getting subpoenas, getting access to the logs that would be needed to track down this? When it's political and not just criminal, then the problem of enforcement is compounded. So state cooperation at the criminal level is fairly good. State cooperation when it's political is not as good. And of course, we could argue that this is an area where the United States has a special vulnerability. It's not as popular to say this after the Abu Ghraib incidents, but the U.S. is bound by international laws and at least is more vulnerable to the charge when it has violated international laws than other states. I mean, it was well known that the torture tactics that were used used by other states as well, including the states that were condemning what the U.S. had done in Abu Ghraib. But the U.S. has a special vulnerability on the legal and moral dimension. When we are caught violating the law, it is far more consequential. And so there puts limits and makes the U.S. again an attractive asymmetric target. If the U.S. approaches it from a law enforcement perspective, there's the added problem of conducting the investigation so that all of the information can be introduced in a court of law. And you may be familiar with the FBI sting operation chasing down the Russian hackers, where they ran afoul of that. These all combine to suggest that if you are disliking the United States, this is an attractive way to express your dislike for the United States and to take a conflict that might have been on a different shore and bring it back to the U.S. And we're going to now take a closer look at what we would consider to be the prototypical example of this phenomenon. The U.S. was not directly involved in this, but nevertheless, it's sort of a test bed and a demonstration of how this phenomenon might transpire.
All right, let's look at the Middle East cyber war. And one of the aspects about it is there is plenty of conflict, and I guess there always has been and will be, according to most folks, in the Middle East. But lately, this has been a new avenue for participation. And it's been an avenue for participation for a lot of folks who don't live in the Middle East, people who might not volunteer to be a suicide bomber, but can, with one click of a button, allow their computer resources to be used for denial of service attack while they sleep at night in North Carolina. There's a large Palestinian community, there's a large Jewish community within the United States and elsewhere, and there are lots of folks who have participated in this. What you'll see is that the intensity of the cyber attacks has largely mirrored and mostly followed the intensity of fighting on the ground. I'll show you examples that came in response to kidnappings, suicide bombings, and the like. The core hackers, they're not that many, and a lot of their names are known, and I can show you some pictures and names and websites. The volunteers are well into the thousands, and they, if you might be familiar with the SETI project, in which you can let your computer search for extraterrestrial life in the universe, in the background of your processing power. Volunteers provide brute force scanning power, denial of service power, and they really come from just about everywhere. And this is significant because, you know, there's Israel and then there's the occupied territories. You have the West Bank and Gaza, and who do you think is in control of their internet infrastructure in the occupied territories? It is the Israeli government. So NetVision, the biggest ISP in Israel, obviously is going to hinder a lot of cyber activity coming out of the territories. Here you can see some of the homelands of the volunteers. And so I've put on the left the usual suspects, but on the right you can see that, you know, Europe, the United States in particular, is the largest player in international politics with the most robust IT infrastructure. Also Brazil, very interesting. Brazil, if you know something about their relations with the United States, a lot of tension there in the past. So Brazil was only too happy to lend their expertise to the pro-Palestinian cause, as well as the Pakistanis here. Here you can find spontaneous alliances that arise, especially in warfare that's conducted via the internet. Let's go on and see some of the sites attacked. Now, you'll notice here that apart from the United States, they're all at least Arab or Muslim or Jewish. And again, for the same reasons, the United States can expect to take shots in just about any cyber conflict because we are at the epicenter both of politics and internet infrastructure around the world. Now, here's a lot of the tools that were used by both sides during the conflict. And it's just kind of interesting to mention a couple of them. Of course, the ping of death, you know, the 164K packet that can crash your older machine. EvilPing was designed expressly for this conflict, and it's a distributed ping of death. WinSmurf was used. One side claimed that it was able to use one 56K modem to bring down a popular pro-Arab site, Almanar.org. With this one modem, they were able to simulate 10,000 attacks at once using the amplifying power of broadcast sites. Quickfire, they aimed that at the Israeli Foreign Ministry email server and brought it down, and it took days for it to come back up. Let's look at one in particular. This was a tool that both sides used. FloodNet tools were very popular in 2001, And essentially, you're just, you know, you're making web requests that essentially will, they will overtax a server's resources and deny that information or that service to legitimate parties. But at the time, this was relatively a novel attack method with the defend tool, in that one of the security web security mechanisms was a caching feature. And so, you know, if the same person is asking for the same information within the same 10 minutes, you don't go back, you know, and fetch it from the archives. You just say, hey, why don't you have a look at what you've already got? Well, this method with the defend attack tool, in the script, it kept specifying the current date and time. So, and it would do this once a second. So it'd say, no, I don't want, you know, the URL page from a second ago. I want it from this second. And at the time, it defeated web caching security mechanisms. And this tool worked very well. It was responsible for dozens of successful attacks. There were many versions developed, and they were mirrored all over the world. And in some of the places I was looking through the list, it's hysterical. There were even web portals that were in the .to domain. .to belongs to who? Tonga, very good. And Tonga is where? South Pacific is an island monarchy in the South Pacific, actively taking part in the Middle East conflict, and I'm sure unbeknownst to them. So this tool is a very simple tool, but very effective at the time. Again, it came along at the right time when the iron was hot and the fighting was intense and very effective. And the more people that clicked on this button and allowed their computer to take part, the more effective it was. The victims were quite different, and this is interesting. On the Israeli side, in the Middle East cyber war, the unofficial war was begun on the Israeli side, and most of the victims were political, ideological, organizational in nature. They went after Hamas. They went after Hezbollah. These are extremist organizations, some of which were based in Lebanon, and I'll show you in a minute, there was a lot of activity going on in Lebanon at the time that was arousing interest around the world, but in particular in Israel. And if you've ever been there, you know how intense life is there and how they live from minute to minute based on the news. So they were going after organizational extremist sites. They branched out toward government sites in the states surrounding them, in particular to Iran and Lebanon. Pro-Palestinian sites, on the other hand, they had the targets were such that the pro-Israelis probably wished they'd never started the conflict in the first place. The .il domain gave pro-Palestinian attackers a fixed target to go after, and they could methodically work their way through .il sites much more quickly than the other side could look at essentially the entire world and try and find what to attack. And there were so many successful attacks on the Israeli side. It was dozens of times the number relatively quickly. Sure, they went after the Israeli government, but what they also had to go after were a lot of successful Israeli businesses. A lot of e-commerce sites were down for a long period of time. And the thing is, okay, if you're government, you can lose face, and that's bad enough. But if you're a business, you're relying on income. And it's been proven that certain businesses in particular, like online gambling, porn sites, I mean, they can make up to millions of dollars a minute. And if you take them down for 4 days, that's quite a significant loss in revenue and an investment that they have to undertake for future defense. All kinds of sites were attacked, not just websites, but you can see really the gamut. And it's very interesting. I mean, because these guys, the core hackers, they know where to go. And so they knew, the IRC channels that the other side was using, to distribute information for attacks against them. And all of these things, it escalated in very focused fashion, not only to the governments, but also to the other parties that were using the tools. And whenever tools were used, of course, the other side would grab them and rewrite them to attack the other side's sites. And so you went back and forth in that manner. Here is you're looking at the screen that was responsible for the start of the unofficial war, October 5th, 2000. This is the Hezbollah site in Lebanon. And just for a little bit of context, Hezbollah means Party of God, and it's a Muslim, depending on which side, of course, Israelis feel like it's a terrorist group, and the pro-Palestinians would say it's a resistance group, and And they're based in Lebanon. And at the time, Lebanese guerrillas had seized Israeli soldiers and were holding them for ransom. And this site, this Hezbollah site, also had a lot of great information from their perspective for propaganda purposes on for their own site. They had video clips of Israeli attacks in the territories. They had testimonials of Palestinian prisoners, etc. So it made a juicy target, and it came at a very at a time when the fighting was hot. Okay, so they wake up on the morning of October 25th, and visitors to this site didn't get the usual stuff they were they were after. Instead, their computer started playing the Israeli national anthem, and across it, both in Arabic and Hebrew and in English, you have to we're going to mention this later, but not only do you need the technical skill to conduct these attacks, but you have to have the smarts. You have to know what to say. And many times, especially with the United States, that may be the most difficult aspect to a successful cyber attack. Okay, we can get inside your network pants, but do we have any idea what to do when we get there? Do we know what to say? There's a cultural, there's a historical, there's a religious gap between our target audience, especially if they're in the Middle East, and what we think we might say to another American. Here's an example of a site. You can see the Hebrew writing here, and this is explaining how to go about attacking the other side. You can see webmaster at Hezbollah.com, PNA, that's Palestinian National Authority. There are downloads here. I just cut it off, but just below, I couldn't fit everything on here, but just below that, you could download emailbomber.zip, Hezbollah webstorm.zip. And this is, in Hebrew writing, explaining how to go about it. The Wizel.com, that was one of the most popular attack portals at the time. So that's the kind of site that a pro-Israeli could go to and just, with a couple of clicks, allow their computer's resources to be used, even if they had no idea, what the tool was doing, to attack targets that had been identified by some of the core hackers on the other side. And this is very interesting. Okay, now what do you want to do if you're an attacker? There are just so many levels to think about this. One of the things you want to do is make your hack sticky. You want it to be difficult for the other side to get out from underneath it. And so the Israeli side, they said, okay, we're going to attack the Hezbollah side. And we know that there are several different ways to spell Hezbollah, and we know that people are going to, they might think they've been to the wrong site, or the Hezbollah guys may say, well, we'll just try a different spelling, we'll register that and configure it and put our site there. Well, the Israelis were ready for that. And so they had already registered and purchased and configured these sites, various spellings and misspellings of the word, and they had put all of their propaganda already there. So folks wanting to go to the Hezbollah sites after the attack were foiled again when they wanted to try and retrieve the information, and they got more Israeli propaganda. Okay. Here are some of the Israeli hackers. Now, in the past, before the Arab-Israeli hacker war really got going, these guys were mostly known for attacking U.S. sites, and this really annoyed the pro-Palestinians to no end, because they felt like these guys hadn't come under enough censure from our side for what they had done in the United States. The two at the top, Derry Shriedman and the analyzer, that's Ehud Tannenbaum, both of those guys, it's funny, the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War, both of them at 18 years of age conducted successful hacks of the Pentagon, and both of them eventually caught for this. The second one, the analyzer, actually, he had 47 FBI agents at one time trying to track him down. If you can imagine the cost in that alone to the United States, tying up so many agents for a period of time. And of course, all of these guys, especially the analyzer, they wound up going on to start their own computer security firms once this was over. But it's very interesting. One of them, Tannenbaum, he started this 2XS site, and they wound up sending out letters all around Israel once this got going, and it really, they were necessary for reasons I was telling you earlier. They sent out letters saying, you have security problems on your site. They were scanning the .il domain. They said, we can protect you from hacks by malicious attacks coming from Islamic groups. And they signed it White Hatted Hacker Group, eventually became this company. You know, but they, you know, they realized this. They posted a lot of the hacks and defacements on their site, and so they're drumming up business from this hacker war. The Israeli Internet Underground, I'll just mention lastly, this was a group of ethical, anonymous individuals from Israeli tech firms. And they were playing an active part in trying to publicize what was going on. According to them, the 8% dip in the Israeli stock market in that period, that three-month period at the end of the year 2000 in the Israeli stock market was directly attributed to this. The polo on the left I mentioned quickly, this very interesting case, he was able to amass a lot of sensitive information about Palestinian leadership figures, including their cell phone numbers, fax numbers, the ways they communicated, and they would just publish this online for folks to annoy them with. Here is one of their sites. I'll just mention this briefly, but here's one of the portals, and through this site you could conduct ping floods against Hezbollah and Hamas. They even you post their pictures, which is interesting. Does that mean they're not afraid of law enforcement chasing them, or they were just not very smart? Here are Mossad defacements. And the Mossad, if you don't know, is the name of the Israel Intelligence Service. And this hacker obviously took his name from that. You can see he had 67 defacements. Here's some interesting ones. Okay. You can see he was responsible for an attack on the Iranian presidency. Here are the top star. This is from Zone H. And the ones with the stars on them are special defacements. So these are government/military. That's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Iran. And if you go on to some of the .com, .net, .edu, you can see that they're all Islamic, Arab, and or Muslim related. They go to Pakistan as well as Iran. QA is Qatar. The targets that they went after, you'll find that they were very close to the fighting on the ground. We mentioned Hezbollah and Hamas. They moved to Palestinian National Authority and then off to Iran. The Hamas attack is very interesting because it increased some speculation that Israeli intelligence might be involved in this. Hamas had extreme difficulty ridding itself of this attack. They were down for days. Folks who wanted to go to the Hamas website, they wound up on lesbiansex.com, rawsexvideos.com. And whenever somebody tried to close their browser out there in the world who wanted Hamas information, they couldn't close it. It would just immediately fire up another browser in its place. And they had such difficulty getting out, you know, from under this attack that it raised some speculation that there were some really serious folks on the Israeli side were conducting these attacks. And again, this also came right after there were suicide bombings for which Hamas had taken responsibility within Israel. Now, there was searching for more targets because, like I mentioned earlier, there weren't enough Palestinian targets to attack. In any case, Israel is in charge of the Palestinian connections to the internet. So they moved. They moved to Iran. They moved to Lebanon. There's a case with Lebanese television that I just want to mention because it shows you can watch the evolution of the conflict over time. By the time they hit this site, they were ready. And in a few hours, they had a replacement site back up and running. They were down for a few hours. Here, this is the last slide on the Israeli side. It just shows, again, some evolution over time, and this is currently up. This is a self-proclaimed Israeli hacker collective, magaf.org, and they're providing a lot of tools out there. Here, they have an advertisement for something called the Jabber protocol, which can be used for encrypted instant messaging. It's encryption communication software. What you can see, though, is there'll be a lot of overlap between, say, hackers here who have their own pet projects, even the Arab or Muslim hackers on the other side of the Middle East, and groups like this. On this site, for instance, I found references to a couple of, one is called Indie Media, which is independent media reporting, sort of really back, sort of, non-state controlled reporters and media outlets. And the other one was the Ruckus Society, which some people in here, especially this weekend, may know about, but it's an anarchist group who are largely responsible for the disrupting the WTO convention in Seattle in 1999. Okay, so there was a quick counterattack by the pro-Palestinian side. I mentioned they could work methodically through .IL sites. They quickly surpassed many times the number of defacements. They were able to you know, conduct successful attacks, such as paralyzing the email of the in particular the Israeli Foreign Ministry. What the moving through the .IL domain meant was often you got, you know, grade schools, you got, you know, really generic things that were out of the way, very far removed from the conflict, and potentially even a lot of pro-peace sites, you know, would be hit. Because once you have a target like that, you're dealing with a lot of vulnerable sites that may not necessarily be that significant or political that, you would have gone after because it was important. You hit it because it was vulnerable. Okay, we mentioned how wired the country is, but the more boxes you have, the more targets there are to hit. Okay, Israel has more internet connections than all of the Arab countries combined. So you can only imagine that many boxes, that many targets, it was relatively easy for a swift and powerful counterattack. Some of the pro-Palestinian hackers, ArabHackers.org, that's a place where they get together online, and so you can see maybe what they're up to if you want to visit. Dodi is a very skilled hacker. He was responsible for going after NetVision as well in Israel, which again runs about 70% of the traffic in and out of the country. GeForce Pakistan is an interesting case because their experience that they had with from the Pakistan-India hacker wars was immediately apparent. They joined the war on November 3rd, 2000. And the number of sites that were defaced and in interesting, innovative, and powerful ways was immediately shown, and it created such a stir in the pro-Israeli community that some of the groups within Israel threatened GeForce Pakistan. If you don't stay out of this war, you know, we're going to hack your country to death, and vice versa. And so it made for an interesting sideshow to the whole conflict, all the way down to El Muhajirun, which has fairly close ties to extremist groups, to include al-Qaeda and, according to them, Osama bin Laden. And so they are trying to unify all these groups in sort of a cyber jihad against Israel and the United States of America. Here you can see one of their sites, okay? Just like on the Israeli side, here's a site in which was telling volunteers exactly what to do. Okay, here's a core hacker saying, you will attack the following IPs. You will attack the following domains. Just click on these sites. Now, just below this, it said, okay, upon clicking Defend the Resistance, an automatically programmed file will be ready to stage counterattacks against the Zionist websites. This counterattack will continue as long as you have access to the internet. One small window will be opened for you for each link you click, and all you have to do is not close them. This program will automatically work. Now, propaganda is really something we want to emphasize here. The Palestinians, especially, you know, this kind of picture, a picture of a dead body in a street, is potentially much more effective than writing graffiti, greets to mo friends, you know, in, you know, X country. You know, one picture, you know, this kind of picture, very powerful. And so, again, this is asymmetric in nature. You have the weaker side, the weaker party, that can employ these kinds of techniques. You don't need any hacking skill at all to, you know, have a GeoCities website devoted to your side's grief or your problems. If you've got a couple of pictures of them, you've got a digital camera, and you have a modem, this kind of thing is fairly easy to do, but extremely effective. Here is a much more professional group, Unity. They had a four-step plan to bring down Israel. First, you were going to hit the Israeli government sites. Second, economic, the Bank of Israel, the stock exchange. Third, you were going to hit the ISP infrastructure. And fourth, anything you could hit that would cause, that would lessen Israel's ability to support its security forces on the ground. So here, you know, you can see an attempt on the cyber side to affect change, you know, in the physical world. This is also interesting. On this site, didn't show it, but there is an oath. Now, you can only imagine how effective this oath is, but I saw it on both sides. Here's the oath. I swear that I will not use these programs on anyone but Jews and Israelis. Right? So that's up to you, right, if you're a web surfer, to follow that oath. Otherwise, I'm sure you can attack who you want. Here's an example of a non-cyber cyber attack. Okay, this is the same site, Ooma.com, that housed the Unity attack portal. And if you can't read it, it says, the bandwidth providers to our ISP, after receiving many complaints from the Zionists and their supporters in the UK, have threatened to cut off our internet access. Therefore, we are removing this site. Most sincere apologies, the Ooma.com team. And of course, the beauty of the internet, you can just move this somewhere else, right? You can move it to GeoCities or something. But this is significant because this was a very visible site. Ooma.com is huge. It's very important in the Arab world. They were allowed to house an attack portal. But again, there were so many complaints in the UK that they had to take it offline. The pro-Palestinian targets. Okay, I've already mentioned, once you finish with the government, there was economic sites to go after here. They ranged from very sophisticated attacks to like a lot of the fake mail and the sort of the mail bombing attacks that the Likud party received, thousands of emails, essentially just saying, death to Jews, hell is waiting for you, et cetera, et cetera. That is still a powerful counterattack if it drives you insane and floods your email server until you can figure out what to do about it. AIPAC, I want to mention, because that is an example of the Middle East cyber war moving to the United States. AIPAC is, if you don't know, that's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in Washington, D.C. And that website was hacked, and databases were stolen for the email addresses, personal information, and credit card information of their members. Now, that's pretty fairly powerful. If you can publish it online or you can use them in a nefarious way. But again, it's an example of the conflict not only moving to the States, but also moving potentially into the personal lives of some of the folks who are supporting, the other side. AT&T, I'll mention, is a very interesting case. The Israeli army came under such a heavy cyber onslaught that they contracted out to AT&T for support, for server support, for space, to back up and keep their services online. So who do you think was the next target of the cyber warriors that were pro-Palestinian? They started hitting AT&T, and they sent around emails encouraging a boycott of the company. Again, a non-cyber cyber attack, but potentially powerful. GeForce Pakistan started rerouting traffic from AT&T to its competitor Quest. So again, AT&T had to decide. They had a decision to make. Holy cow! Are we going to continue with this, or are we going to are we going to give up? And in this case, they decided they were just going to have to batten down the hatches and stick with their plan and support the Israeli army. And fight it out themselves. So it's an example of also a company jumping right into the cyber war.
Moving back from the Middle East to the United States, the U.S., as Kenneth indicated, became involved in this, not just as a supporter of Israel, but now as a target. And as the largest player in international politics, the most robust information technology system, the U.S. is an extremely attractive target for this kind of assault. We should emphasize that this is not weapons of mass destruction. This is not going to bring the United States to its knees in terms of economic impact, large-scale economic impact. On the other hand, the U.S., it can have considerable localized effect. And as we'll see in a moment, the propaganda side, it can be quite devastating. The interesting thing about the Middle East cyber war was the way that the cyber conflict mirrored in a dismal way the conflict of that was going on in the kinetic realm. But it's also possible that this kind of posses of the willing could hijack a conflict and take it beyond where it had gone in the kinetic realm. And as a sort of a suggestive way that that might happen, take a look at the incidents between the U.S. and China. Recall in spring of 2001 when the Navy spy plane, the EP-3, was downed by the Chinese for several weeks of very, very tense diplomatic crisis for the United States. Not quite at the level of the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, but nevertheless a very intense diplomatic challenge for the United States. And that political contest inspired hacking and counter-hacking from Chinese and the U.S. So the Chinese built portals for attacking the United States. U.S. Patriotic hackers established portals for attacking China. One particularly effective one was Poison Box. We don't know who that person is, but we think someone out there today or tomorrow might know. And let us know if you can clue us in on that. But here was an example of escalating a crisis that the governments were trying to tamp down. But this had, as more and more people got involved, it had the potential of accelerating a crisis, throwing gasoline on the fire. And just imagine the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was happening when by small groups of governmental officials were deciding both sides and the rest of the world was watching. They had a hard enough time shutting down that crisis short of war. When there are many, many other actors involved with their own agendas and certainly not necessarily responsive to governmental decree, the problem can be intensified. What's interesting is that the Chinese side may be more responsive to governmental decree than the American side. On the anniversary of that downing, they had promised an anniversary attack, basically, in 2002. And within a short period of time, a couple of days before that attack was scheduled to take place, it was stopped. The lead elements in the group said, we will not do this, and no one did it. So there was a much more centralized command and control system, at least on the Chinese side, possibly responding to governmental pressure, because at that point the Chinese did not want to revive the Chinese government did not want to revive the conflict with the United States. Now, there's a perception reality problem in this area. In the early days of the internet age, there was a lot of hyperbole about how cyber warfare was going to replace kinetic warfare, and it was going to supplant the traditional forms. And it's quite obvious that that hasn't happened yet, and it probably won't happen. At the same time, it can work in harness with traditional warfare and can add a new dimension or a new arena for conflict, and importantly, bringing in people who might not otherwise be involved. So it's that posses of the willing notion that could change it. It's not weapons of mass destruction. It's not a 9/11 attack, but nevertheless, it is important and worth guarding against. How is the U.S. and other states doing in guarding this? At the national level, the policies are still in flux. In that sense, it's very similar to the early nuclear age. The first 5 or so, 10 years of the nuclear age, the U.S. was still feeling its way on what the impact of nuclear weapons would be and how, at a national level, they were to respond and deal with the nuclear age. Europe, as you know, did the somewhat King Canute effort of trying to stop the tide and say it'll absolutely stop it all. The U.S. has a much more laissez-faire attitude. It's unlikely that international agreements with any bite to them will be established. And certainly, if they have bite to them, be unlikely that they would be enforced at a level that would make a difference. And so you see a tremendous temptation for the government to get involved, saying, if we can't stop this with treaties, maybe we should be involved ourselves, including perhaps encouraging white hat hacking. Can these things affect kinetic military operations? Well, it can certainly affect in the run-up to the conflict through compromising intelligence collection, which we now know is even more compromised than we thought. You can mess with the threat, the indications and warning, and importantly, propaganda. And propaganda and a new domain that is becoming available just in the Iraq War is the phenomenon of military blogs. So blogs that are by military guys while they're deployed in the combat theater, an opportunity to go in and poison those logs with and basically put in propaganda that would back your side. In the U.S., Chinese case suggests the possibility that these could spin out of control and get out of the government's control. And in this sense, it's reminiscent of the East India Company and its effect on the British Empire. I don't know if you're familiar with the history, but the East India Company was a private or a quasi-private commercial enterprise that was had a license from the British government to operate in India, but it was a private firm. And gradually, on its heels came Christian missionaries. And in 1857, the company got into trouble because there was a rumor started that they were going to force the sepoys, who were the Indian troops that they had hired help police India, to force them to use musket balls that had, or packets that had been dipped in pig grease. This was not true. This was a rumor, but it spread quickly, led to the uprising of 1857. Too big for the business to handle, so they call in the British military force, British government. British government came in, and as a result of that, the Queen Victoria became Empress of India. It was private, semi-private, and commercial enterprises dragging Britain into a formal conflict and then eventually the formal takeover of India. Similar dynamics, we would argue, could be in play with the cyber conflict in today's world. And in it's sort of a move back to the pre-modern or to the feudal period of business, private groups, and where the state has not the monopoly on the legitimate use of power. What's the most powerful form? It's propaganda. And this, of course, is the infamous photos of the Abu Ghraib torture. And these were real photos of real torture. But interestingly, you can also have faked photos. And they doctored photos of British soldiers doing this. They were fake, but nevertheless had the same impact in Britain. Somewhat less of an impact on Britain than it had in the United States, but nevertheless, profound impact on Britain, even though they were just faked photos. And we would argue that this form of cyber propaganda, if you will, was the most damaging, probably more damaging than all other forms of cyber attacks on the United States since the beginning of the Internet age. You see, just in recent months, the groups hacking onto a site so as to post the beheadings of the hostages in Iraq, and one was a site in California, the other one was a site in Arkansas. Corporate bounties, of course, going after hackers, likewise, and the idea of what your business, I shouldn't be telling you about your business, but of corporate espionage and counter-espionage. Where will this go? Just wrapping up now. We think that this phenomenon will increase. We think that the next time the U.S. is in a crisis with whatever state, there will be a cyber component to it that will be involved, not just state-directed, but be beyond the state control. Likewise, we're convinced that the sophistications of the attacks will increase. There's a trend over time, and within each incident just within the one case, a trend towards greater sophistication as it goes. And a question for the group would be, will traditional activists and extremists begin to work with hacker groups? The anti-globalization forces is often put forward as the locus of where this would join up. And why don't we leave it there and take questions from the audience? Yes, sir. Right. That the question was, in the good old days, the way you signaled that a coup had happened in Africa was to take over the televisions and announce that you were the new coup leader. Perhaps taking over the website will function in that same capacity in future conflict. I think it won't have the exact same effect as taking over the television station, because to do that you actually had to have physical control on the ground, whereas, as you know, you can take over websites without physical control of it. So I suppose it won't function the exact same way, but it will be a form for taking over and promoting propaganda on this, and I would see it doing in that capacity. Other questions? Yes.
The question was coordination between physical and cyber attacks? Yeah, that's one of the big fears. Everybody's planning for sort of an assault on 911 during a period of crisis. But that is a very good question. I have had people tell me that the great blackout from a couple years ago in New England was entirely doable from a hacker's perspective. And I think that from a defensive perspective, you have to assume that the adversary is working on such plans, even if we haven't seen it. You know, in Australia, there was the case of the ex-sewage worker flooding, you know, and nobody knew about it till days later, and the area was really stinking up pretty bad. And the guy had, once he, you know, had left his business, I think he had flooded, or he had, you know, somehow hacked into the system and ruined some of the, you know, set false settings. I think that the some of the things I can think of, I mean, depends on, a lot of it is social engineering, and a few weeks ago, for instance, when there was going to be a commemoration of the Tiananmen Square attacks in Hong Kong, somebody got a hold of the email addresses of all the folks who were planning on participating and organizing and showing up at the event, and they all received an email on the eve of the event saying that the event had been canceled. So I think some of it involves, again, we think that the United States probably is well behind the curve on being internet savvy. And the thing is social engineering techniques combined with a technological skill can exponentially increase the power of an attack. And that is something you have to take into account. And even if we haven't seen examples of it yet, I think you have to imagine them planning for that. Those sorts of attacks in the future.
Have you seen
Well, I think that if you look at sort of the Falun Gong in China, you know, I mean, they're being severely repressed, but they're very internet savvy. And we have definitely seen indication that they are communicating with such, you know, covert channels. Covert channels are very hard to find because by definition, they are going to look like real traffic, stuff that you can't watch for, you can't write, you know, rules for, and you know, in your firewall, your IDS, and so very tough to find. I think when folks are placed in a corner like the Falun Gong, or if you can imagine intelligence agents stationed overseas, that kind of thing. I've been up late at night, for instance, in Egypt, listening to the radio, and you turn it, you know, you just keep turning the radio, and you will go to a station. And I remember this lady, I listened to it for the longest time. It was so interesting. She was reading 4, 6, 5, 2, 4, 6, 5, 2 for hours. I mean, it was so interesting. Somebody out there was receiving a fairly interesting message, and they wanted to get it to them pretty bad. But, you know, covert channel is very tough. You know, how do you write rules for that? How do you find it in traffic? You can only imagine that, you know, espionage and that folks who maybe not WTO protesters, but if you're talking about the kind of persecution that's going on in China with the Falun Gong, they're going to move to that, and they're going to find out ways to communicate for sure. Number stations. Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the things we noticed, one of the main differences between...
Repeat the question.
I'm sorry. He was wondering, you know, on the relationship in this country, perhaps, between government and hacker groups, and what sort of coordination or cooperation might be possible. Yeah, it's very interesting. That's one of the main differences between the Chinese and the USA case. You know, is that we saw the USA hackers, they're going to be very independent. You know, they're going to do what they want. You know, I mean, this is our ethos, our government, our history, background, you know, individual rights and roles in society. In China, not so. Very different. I mean, no expert on China, but I think their way of thought, their thinking, you work in a coordination, and you work as a team in China. And so with the great patriotic hacker war of 2002 that was called off at the last minute, you can see that there's probably some kind of command and control structure. We don't know that, but it appears so. But I think also within their culture, people do things for the betterment of the country and with a mind for history and in the future and that sort of thing. Not so here. I think you're going to find that the government, probably a blue suit versus the kind of folks who are going to show up at DEFCON this weekend, you know, no chance. They're not speaking the same language.
Well, that it's a good question you're asking. I assume folks heard that, so I don't need to repeat that. One of the interesting things about the ideology of jihad is that it is meant to be mandatory on all believers. So it's a call for everybody. It's not a call for state action. It's a call for individual action. And I think it lends itself very well to this form of cyber warfare for precisely that reason, that it provides a logical political ideology for mobilizing individuals to act in a conflict. And we think that that is that's the novel aspect of the cyber warfare that we wanted to stress here, was precisely the posses of the willing responding to a call. And I think it lends itself, the jihad concept lends itself very well to precisely that phenomenon. Yes, on both sides, as you say, and I should have mentioned that the other aspect of the conflict is that it is a conflict that grips the public attention all over the world. It has a focus far in excess of the human toll. As bad as the human toll of suffering there, it's trivial compared to the suffering in Sudan, for instance, the southern Sudan, which received almost no attention outside of a handful of groups that were interested in it. And so there's 2 million dead, and in the Palestinian-Israeli case, it's what, several thousand since the second intifada. Terrible, but much less. Nevertheless, preoccupying publics and governments all over the world. It is a conflict that, because both communities have supporters distributed all over the world, it lends itself to this kind of activity especially. Yes, sir. Right. Two responses, and then Kenneth may have more. First of all, I think it actually matches the countermeasures dynamic of kinetic warfare. So in kinetic warfare, there's been a trend of a longer range, so you get better better armor plating on your tanks, so you develop armor piercing, and then you develop countermeasures to that. And I think that same dynamic is happening in the cyber realm. But in terms of the use it and then lose it phenomenon that you described, one of the reasons why the Chinese, we think that the Chinese called off their second attack, the anniversary attack in 2002, at least the rationale that they offered was, why give the United States a free threat vulnerability assessment? If we did this, we would be doing their work for them, and it would be a once and done thing, and then they would close it. And so we'll save it for when we really need it. And that illustrates, I think, the phenomenon you were describing.
Okay, we better just take one more question. I think they're going to need this room.
Oh, we got 10 minutes.
Oh, we got time. All right.
The question was, what particular vulnerabilities could the Chinese exploit that the U.S. has, in particularly delaying U.S. coming to the aid of Taiwan to deal with that crisis? And there was a lot of speculation that pro-Iraqi groups would do this to the United States during the run-up to the second Gulf War, that they would interfere with the deployment features, and it's something that the U.S. government has spent an awful lot of effort trying to counteract and harden. And I think it's generally recognized that there was more snafus imposed by higher-ups meddling in the United States than into the TPFID and into the deployment than it was from outsiders backing it. Now, it is also the case that that Saddam Hussein didn't have many friends. And so it probably was the success that the U.S. had in terms of avoiding significant cyber attacks during the deployment phase is probably owed some to the fact that Saddam Hussein was pretty much alone. And I think you're right that the Chinese, who have invested very, very heavily in this capacity, would be able to do more the next if it came to that against the United States. I think that they could reasonably complicate the logistics. Now, that's why we wanted to emphasize these are harassing, not lethal destruction. But they could complicate the logistics, and then the U.S. would have to innovate on the spot to get around it. My own view is that they wouldn't be able to stop it, but they could complicate it, harass it, otherwise add friction sort of into the works. But if it comes to that conflict is not going to be decided at through a conventional war of attrition. That's going to be decided probably diplomatically, with Taiwan facing extreme economic vulnerabilities on the one hand, or it'll be stopped because of the potential for escalation to the nuclear level. So I would, while the Army has to prepare, or the military has to prepare against a conventional scenario, it seems less likely that it would reach a conventional scenario that it would be decided diplomatically.
Ready? The question was hacktivism versus more of warfare, you know, that would be international or interethnic or something along those lines. Now, I think there are some similarities and some differences, but we're definitely suggesting that anti-globalization forces, you know, may provide a good group of folks for these sorts of attacks, these sorts of strategies. Because you've got, you know, targets such as corporations, you've got a target such as a WTO or a conference, Stad conference, that sort of thing. I think at certain levels there's differences, but absolutely not. We definitely want to address hacktivism in the sense of what took place in Seattle in 1999 could potentially take place on the web. The event still took place in Seattle. But it was very embarrassing. It was very annoying to a lot of people, and it did raise a lot of, it had a lot of public relations value for the Ruckus Society and other groups that put it on, for the anarchists. In the same way, it might be analogous to web defacements and denial of service attacks. It's annoying. It takes time and effort and money to get out from underneath. It's not going to stop the deployment, but it could delay it, could complicate it, and it could be good for public relations. It could be good for recruiting and for fundraising for that particular group.
We're getting the hook signal, and so we'll thank you and leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.